Okay, Jim Houghton, not Horton or Houghton.
Correct.
Thank you very much. Jim Houghton from Waypoint. This is going to be a unique podcast, even by you just being here, because never in our 71 episodes have we ever brought somebody on that specializes in numbers, spreadsheets, and M&A. We're going to make it sexy today.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, congrats on 71. That's impressive.
Thank you very much.
But I'll pull you up straight away. And if I had to characterize myself, would I think I specialize in spreadsheets? I think M&A is much more about people and strategy than it is numbers. But like, I know you're a Q&A machine, so I'm sure we'll get to that part later.
We're 100% going to get there. Thank you.
You need regulating first thing in the morning.
Indeed. Yeah. That is what I need. Yeah. Deep regulation the whole time. But actually getting into that, because there's three forms of this podcast. Number one, I want to hear your rant. But before I do that, I need to kind of set the context of who you are and where we're going today. The key reason why I brought you here is because I believe that creative people don't know enough about money people. And money people don't know enough about creative people. And I've always felt like if they did collide with each other more often, if Liverpool Street collided with Shoreditch perhaps more often, the possibilities could be quite endless, really. Because I think a creative person goes throughout their life almost fearful, almost not feeling good enough or smart enough to have a conversation with a money person. And they could reach 50, 60, 70 years old, always believing that they weren't ever smart enough to speak to a money person. And I also think the other thing on the vice versa to that is true, in that a finance guy or girl can go throughout their whole life never feeling cool enough to have a conversation with a creative person. Oh, I'm going to bore the life out of them because I'm not going to speak about numbers. When again, that isn't true. So why I wanted to do this today is A, because I really wanted to demystify and clarify what finance really means and how a creative person who could be listening to this podcast right now can change their life and probably generations after them if they just understood money a bit better. But before we do that, three key points I wanted to make before I get onto your rant.
I want
you ranty today.
Okay, I'll try.
Okay, before we get to the rant, you've worked in M&A for 30 years.
Ish.
Your first ever deal was acquiring AMV for Omnicom, which is mental, because I've always just presumed.
Yeah, if you're going to start, you might as well start big.
Yeah. That is wild. Yeah. And you probably, I'm saying probably here because we haven't landed on an official number, bought and sold over 100 businesses, let's say.
Oh, yeah, comfortably, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So before we get into that, what is your room 101?
My room 101. Okay, so my rant. Look, I'm not really a ranty person.
Okay.
You know, but let me... I think through that experience of 20-odd, nearly 30 years now of M&A stuff, I've been really fortunate to work, travel around the world just in the marketing services industry, largely on the back of the Omnicom payroll, but also, you know, as an advisor for 15, 20 years since. So you get to see lots of different business cultures, lots of different work cultures, and that kind of takes you more into sort of culture generally. Mm-hmm. So if I contrast... UK, and this in my head, the ramp piece, it will start to build now.
Okay.
UK versus US versus China versus India. I'm a massive fan of cricket. I love test match cricket. I grew up in a cricket household. The whole 5-day thing, you'd sort of sit there, watch it on the BBC, like hour after hour after hour and never leave the screen. I'm just glued to it. The UK business culture, and this is true of the agency world as much as it is generally, is really anti-failure. Oh, and so in my world, what I've experienced seeing different agency businesses growing, you know, over a life cycle is more risk appetite, bigger success, but more frequent failure in the US, in China, in India, and more, like I start with a really bleak word, more comfortable mediocrity in the UK, because we've got this sort of, like in a test match, it's fine to start in the first over of the first day aspiring to spending the whole 5 days just not losing. That's perfectly acceptable. That's an honourable draw, right? That concept of honourable draw, that's just mental. Like in the world in which we operate and in which agencies operate, going out there because we've got this sort of protected society, we all, you know, so many Brits are fortunate enough in life to start with stuff that they're worried about losing.
Yeah.
If you're scrapping building an agency in a converted warehouse in Mumbai, you're not sitting there feeling like you've got a bunch of stuff to lose. You're prepared to punt things and just try stuff until you get successful big, as opposed to the UK, you'll play the test match game, right? I'm just not going to lose for 5 days and it'll be honourable, shake hands and have some cucumber sandwiches at the end. Like, you're not doing that in America or China. That's just not the mindset. And if Brits could think about test match cricket like a baseball game, you know, we're going to go out and we're going to play the ball in front of us. We're going to play a team in front of us. The conditions, we're going to have fun. We're going to fail. Like, we're going to have some catastrophic matches where we get absolutely whooped by a position that shouldn't beat us. But when we win, it's going to be spectacular.
Yeah.
Like, if British agency owners, founders had more of that mindset, if they could get themselves in a place where failing was an acceptable product of business occasionally, I think we'd have more successful, more interesting businesses, and we would challenge the other kind of global players much more. And I'd have just seen it year after year after year, and it's really frustrating to see businesses that could be better if they were prepared to take a few more chances, but accept that occasionally it'll go wrong.
I love this. And even like the saying, failure isn't an option, that is almost the definition of anti-innovation. And you look at like Silicon Valley, where the game is to fail and learn, test and learn, iterate, which I guess if iteration by definition, maybe not innovation, iteration is like trying different permutations, versions of things until you figure out the one that works.
Yeah.
Why is that? I want to get into my first question, but why, what is that? Is that post-colonialism? Is that like...
That's a bit of a heavy way to start.
But like, what is that? Like, why?
I mean, I don't know why it is. Like, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a sort of economic historian. But like, basic observation, having worked in America, for example, and been a CFO in America on the East Coast, like in that environment, employment is fragile. Like, you're an employee at will. You know, as long as your employer doesn't discriminate against you and doesn't create a hostile work environment as legally defined, they can ask you leave at any time, two weeks notice, and you're gone. And there's no social security network that sort of supports you in the background. So in the UK, you enjoy protected status really early, but really quickly. You've got stuff to lose as an employee, whereas in the States, you just don't. So you've got to perform. You have to take chances. And being mediocre just doesn't give you security. You're always exposed. So I think, you know, we've got this. It's a good thing. I believe in supporting people and creating protection, but it just plays tricks with your mind. It makes you behave in a different way. You know, the regular monthly paycheck, 6 months notice, all that kind of stuff. It's a different kind of jeopardy you're playing.
I like the saying, never lick the lollipop of mediocrity, otherwise you'll suck forever.
Okay, not heard it, but
But you're suggesting almost that security breeds mediocrity, or being overcomfortable.
Well, I think what security does is it puts a price on taking chances. And if you're not prepared to take chances, or if you're too worried about the downside risk of taking chances, you don't take as many, and therefore you're just less likely to come up with the sort of breakthroughs that are going to make a real difference. And I don't know, your point in your intro around finance people and creative people, I can speak with personal authority as a failed creative person who ended up in finance because I wasn't good enough as a creative. Finance people deeply, deeply respect and admire creative people, absolutely understand that the creative people are the real brains. That's the real genius. Like, finance is a sort of learned skill. Like, trust me, they're kind of, you could teach someone to be a great accountant. You can't teach someone to be Trevor Beattie, right? That's not happening. So I think that sort of, finance and creativity and business success and risk-taking are a real, really interesting combination.
Yeah. I want to get into the beginning of this, right? Because I see this podcast for two people, maybe a third.
Yeah.
Person number one is, maybe they are a creative, maybe they are the child version of Trevor Beattie, or whatever the 2025's version of Trevor Beattie is. They could be 21, 22, 23, whatever. They're thinking about, they're using their skills for creativity, and they're going to probably try and convince their parents that this thing I'm doing could one day lead to not only a six-figure salary, but potentially a seven or an eight-figure exit. Can you imagine? I can make £10 million one day and have generational wealth, mum or dad. So it's for that person as much as it is for the other person who is, perhaps they did take that chance. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they have been running a creative agency, design agency, marketing services business for the last 5 years, 2 years, 10 years. And they could be thinking a bunch of things. Number one, if they're early on, where do I go with this? You know, where do I need to get to for this to equate to a bigger value for me or my family or whoever else? It could be a different person saying, oh, where do I get off? Or, you know, do I acquire a business? Do I think about building out this because I want to get to X, Y, and Z? And then the third audience is somebody that's spectating and watching those worlds. And I think this person could be working within a company. Why did we just sell? What's going to happen? Mm-hmm. You know, could this be positive for me? Because there is so much conversation around M&A leading to, you know, overly rigid systems and, oh God, now I'm partnering with a holding company. Does that mean the fund's going to stop? Or PE, apparently that means that we have to stop being creative and be formulaic, right? There are a load of myths, I imagine, from that third part of the audience where someone probably thinks money and backing equals bad, right? So before we get that, those are my three different audiences. Young person thinking about doing it, person that's doing it, and then person that is probably impacted by the doing of it, whatever it might be. So let's go back. I am a founder. I'm just about to found my own agency.
Okay.
Take me on the journey from doing that and then arriving at the front door of Waypoint, which is your business, which I promised Nat I would do a good job in explaining. Before you answer that question, Waypoint, what I see Waypoint is an M&A company, but the difference in just being another M&A company is that you aren't just transactionally focused. You also work as a coach to companies that want to get to some kind of event. So the difference is, I think some M&A companies go, oh, you're selling your company. Great. Here are five buyers. That isn't what Waypoint does. That's a part of your services. But from what I understand by working in partnership with you, is that you will deeply understand where this person is on their journey and what that person is trying to achieve and whether right now is the right time for them. And then hopefully, if they are the right person on the right journey, you can then coach them and guide them to get the most value out of whatever that is that they have created.
Yeah, look, the coaching word really resonates with us, definitely. When does someone arrive at our doorstep? I mean, that's maybe the way to sort of think about what we do, and without making this a 30-minute advertorial for us. Lots of companies find their way to our front door because they've got to a place where there's something that they can't solve. They don't think they can solve for themselves. They don't think they've got the skills. They haven't got the balance sheet. They don't have the risk appetite. They don't have the international reach to do a particular thing that's on their roadmap for their business or for themselves as individuals. So that's when they'll come and talk to us. But when does that happen? Like, sometimes that happens weeks after they've set the thing up in the first place, or as they're thinking about setting it up, because they're thinking about setting up precisely because I've got a great idea. Mm. I think there's some inherent shareholder value in this thing. I want to make sure that I set the whole thing up right, because in 4 or 5 years' time, I'm planning on making a bunch of money out of this. So it's generally people come to us because there's some sort of challenge or opportunity in their business. A lot of the time that will be sort of, they'll think it's M&A related, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but it's exploring what is the thing in the business or for you as a leader that needs solving for. So for us, it could be you just haven't set the thing up properly, like the company just doesn't work, the organization structure isn't right. But you're right, it comes back to this understanding of business. And M&A is like, it's one of the tools in business, like going and raising debt or bringing in a brilliant recruiter to help you solve your talent challenges. Like, it's one specific thing in the life cycle of a business that can allow it to step change.
Okay.
So we really major on that, and we're known for that. But I'd just as happily talk to you about lining up your incentive structure or thinking about the best ways to grow a business. And if growth is through M&A, then sure, you know, we're brilliant at that. We know loads of people. We're really creative about how we do it.
Yeah.
But we always think about the business and the people before we start thinking about the numbers.
What's going on in that person's head? So when they arrive at a classic, like, let's say, you know, half of the people that arrive at your door will be thinking this before they get there. What's a traditional human that arrives at Waypoint?
At the to it, because I think there are two extremes that illustrate it. So first extreme, the early ones, and look, these guys were not Waypoint clients. I'm not even sure Waypoint existed at the time. But when Bill and Matt set up Analog Folk, I wasn't working with Waypoint. I was just out of Omnicom at the time. And we talked a lot about how they should think about setting it up because they had, you know, all that brilliant experience garnered around DDB. We've got this thing that we think the market should be wanting to buy from us. The market's probably not ready for us yet. But if we set it up like this and we're going to use our partners like this, this is what the kind of business we think we're building and we think it should have value. Jim, we know you like from your Omnicom days. Help us think about that. Are we on the right track? So there's that thing that, so what's in their head? I've got my business idea. I want to make sure the sort of shareholder returns out of that are going to line up with the business idea. That's the sort of early conversation. And the very late conversation, the most extreme example is, I've been really successful down that path. Someone's just dropped an offer on my desk because I've been getting inbound approaches once a week for the last year. Crap, you know, I've kind of left it too late. Help, because I think this is a great offer and I want to respond to it. But anywhere in between those two points, you've got someone who's looking for that, you know, that step change, that unlocking. When we work with Ben and Shah at Born Social, that was like, we really need to grow fast. We've got all these clients that have suddenly landed on our doorstep and we've got to be able to access all these different geographies like now, like in a matter of months. Help, how do we do that? So those sort of conversations, which are natural rather than synthetic, here's a business thing that we want to access that organically we just know isn't going to be possible for us. Those are the ones where you can be really clever about M&A because you've got something to actually work with rather than I'm going to create a transaction because someone needs to retire or they've got a mortgage to pay off, or those things are all doable, but they're not as much fun.
No. Okay. So I'm hearing like lots of different, there's so many different routes that we can go down. I kind of want to start with the first one, which you've mentioned, which is this person that's, you know, maybe they've got some experience. They've been at Holding Co. Because I think we're going to see this quite a lot now.
Oh, yeah, we definitely, with what's going on in the market right now. Yeah. Next 2-3 years. Yeah.
Totally. And this is, I think, is going to be really helpful for, we could even use Rick Brim, Polly McMorrow, and Martin Beverly. They're leaving Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve are owned by Omnicom, a creative agency, and they're probably going to go start their own creative agency, right? It's not private news. It's been out in the press. So let's imagine you're sitting as a holding company and you're looking out and you're saying, wow, I'm craving independence. I've been in this machine for 20 years. Yeah. I would love to do something new where I owned it. And I'm just a bit scared. Where do I start? How do I, you know, how much money do I need? What is my plan? How do I start an independent agency? Where do I start?
Okay, that's a small question. I mean, the great joy about, because the other question you might ask me is, what's a great agency to set up? Like, what's the kind of business you should be setting up? Which, like, you can never answer. But I think it is, it's less true today than it was 10, 20 years ago. Because I think some element of technology which requires cash investment is definitely part of every agency now. I mean, you just can't trade without, maybe you don't need to build your own stuff, maybe there's stuff you can license in, but it's not just two people on a pair of laptops in someone's parents' sort of spare bedroom. I mean, that kind of world doesn't really exist, I think, today.
Why not?
I just, being able to make brilliant creative thinking really work any kind of scale just requires a bit more than that. And you can probably do some of that with off the shelf technology solutions, but where it starts to get interesting, it's a bit funkier than that. I think it's a bit more bespoke, a bit.
Yeah.
So it's probably not just I need two laptops and some space anymore, but but it's still really capital light. So the thing that I would where our conversations tend to go with people who are starting up businesses is try. You should never want to dilute your equity in particular.
As in take investment.
Right. Sorry, yes. Dilute your equity, take investment. If someone's buying some shares, I'm setting the thing up. I'm going to sell some shares to someone in order to give me, you know, 50 grand, to give me a sort of comfortable balance sheet, start trading, pay myself a bit of money over the first few months until clients start paying me. If you give away 10, 20% of your company on day one, versus give it up in 2 or 3 years' time when you're actually making some profits. You know, you're the same amount of value you are giving up, asking that 50 grand is going to cost you a load more money the earlier you do it, right? So you do not want to be selling shares to people earlier than you need to, because it will cost you. And I've seen that as a, when I was a buyer at Omnicom, so many times where someone, someone's mate, someone's family member's given them the 10, 50, 100 grand they needed to kind of get off the ground, and it's cost them 20% of the business. And there's a sort of gentleman's handshake that says, you know, when it comes to it, if there is a sale, don't worry, I won't, you know, I won't need that much money. You know, I'll settle for this. And then, of course, the green eyes, you know, come over you. A deal happens. You can see real cash. You start to smell the money. And people reneging on handshake deals, even close friends who've been friends together for years. It just happens too often. So you always want to start with a business plan that works for you, rather than the sort of mindset, which is, I'm starting a business, I need financial security, let's get someone to put some cash in. Because anyone who's doing that is going to be savvy enough to price it in a way that if you are successful, you're probably going to feel marginally bad about it, or maybe really quite bad about it.
Is there another way? Could you get a business growth loan? Or like, if you're going from a standing start, literally HMRC, you're setting the thing up, you've got your bank account plugged in, £0 in the account, could I go to a bank with an idea of an agency now and then get a loan rather than swap any equity? I'll just give the loan back at 10% over the course of 5 years.
Yeah. Well, look, my answer to that question will depend a little bit on whether or not you decide to use my rant when you get to the final edit of this thing later. Because I think, you know, the UK lending environment, and there are some specialist lenders, right? There are some. But the UK and lending environment is a bit like that test match cricket world. It's very, very, very risk averse.
Okay.
So unless you're operating on an overdraft arrangement from a high street bank, it's not really the kind of economy where you get that sort of friendly, easy to access of mass market funding. It's just not like that. I think it's more about, it is a sort of friends and family market. Mm-hmm. But friends and family would also, if you frame the conversation right, not be looking to aggressively make money on funding they've offered you. So perhaps don't just default to, here's some shares in my company for helping me set it up. Maybe if you could put some money in, I think it'll cost me about 7% to borrow that from the bank. I'll offer you 10% on that money, and maybe a little bit of equity, because I'd like you to share in some of the benefit and the risk you've taken. But it's not all going to be shares. I mean, there are smarter ways of packaging it, but where you're going for the conversation, probably friends and family money to start with.
Okay, that's really good information, because I think that's the, okay, let's say there are three options starting out, right? You do the friends and family, which would be priority number one. Well, actually, number one is money that you've saved, because some people could be working for 30 years. They might have, you know, 100 grand saved. When I started my business, I said I need to have 6 months worth of mortgage. That was my, you know, minimum. I said 6 months because I knew that I would sign a client in my first 3 months, and it will take them about 9 months to pay me. Luckily, they paid me within three, but I knew I'd factored for like 6 months of doing the work, getting the client on, then paying. So I think that's okay. So that's one option is, you know, do it yourself, get a client early on, guarantee that the money's going to be there. Maybe you'll need 3 to 6 months worth of money. Second option is friends and family. Don't immediately default to giving them equity, because that equity could be very valuable down the line. Flip to a better than loan agreement where you offer them 3% or whatever percent more than what a bank is charging you. And then potentially some risk as well. Worst case scenario, swap equity for capital, like seed investment.
Yeah, I'll have to call you up on your use of buzzwords now as well. Seed investment are always kind of jargony things.
Sorry.
But you made a really good point, because I think if you take the example of someone who's come out of, you know, I don't know, a big network agency with the Omnicom IPG merger, there'll be a lot of that in the next few years. Those people might have personal balance sheets that are reasonably robust, that can handle the sort of dynamic you talked about when you set up Unknown. But oftentimes, and there's a bit fiddly. Client loyalty is really strong. Like, we know that clients buy people. CMOs stay with people. They move from one firm to another, and, you know, client accounts move with CMOs. Right? We see that all the time. The number of startups that I've seen that have had maybe a 6 month notice period, some restrictive covenants, and then a client moves and the client effectively provides the funding. I mean, that's the majority of funding on startups in that sort of dynamic, is there's an anchor client that's already lined up. Right. And, you know, the network agency knows it's going to be happening. They've got restrictive covenants, gives them a runoff period, gives them a period to try and secure that client and show them that it can work without that particular individual in the agency. But often they move, and a lot of your funding will come from that.
Okay. Is there, do people like ever do a sweetened deal for that client early on? Do they say like, oh, we'll charge you less because we're going to be smaller, or is it more just like leaning like, in?
Does that happen? I'm sure it does. Does that sound ethical? Definitely not. No. But, you know, I mean, that might be, yeah. I mean, it's business, isn't it? Yeah. And that's that might well be part of the equation.
Okay. All right. We started our agency. We're moving through. Take me from now, right? So where do I want to get this to where do you see companies get to contentment? If we're using like British mentality,
yeah.
What happens now typically to most companies?
I think my old Omnicom boss, a guy called Noel Penrose, who's brilliant and you should get in the studio as well. He used to talk about different stages of maturity using sort of like human development, you know, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, yeah. And the different sort of dynamics that go with each. And I think that's the right way to think about it. The pain points that I see, so where do you get to comfortable?
Mm.
I think you start to feel comfortable when that income pipeline is looking, you know, solid. You've got decent visibility. You can see how your mortgage is getting covered. You can see how you're covering the rent bill and the staff bills each month. I don't know. Agencies get to that at a different point. I don't know, 20, 30 people, whatever it is. But that sort of, and you've got some resilience in the business and everyone starts breathing a bit. And then you start thinking about, well, growth. And now it's the time to start building.
Mm.
That's where life gets actually, perversely, a bit more difficult. That sort of, and again, it depends slightly on, you know, PR companies will have a different organization structure than a media business, you know, somewhat. But that sort of influences it. But the point at which you go from being, I'm Ollie, the founder, mm-hmm. I know what's going on in the business, I know every single staff member, I probably interviewed every single staff member, and effectively, I control every single decision in the company.
Mm.
When you go from management to leadership, because you can't touch every part of the business anymore, you've grown past the point where you've hired everyone and you're managing people indirectly through your direct reports.
Yeah.
Where does that happen? About 50 people, maybe? That's 30, 30, 50, yeah. I don't know. That sort of level, that's when life gets uncomfortable again. So I think comfort starts when you've got that sort of, it's a Maslow thing, you know, okay, breathe. I'm covering the bills. We've got some stability. We've got some predictability. Then you get to, I've got to be more than this now because growing businesses are important. People want to come join a growing business with opportunity to grow their roles, grow their clients, et cetera. That's the difficult bit. So I think when you get to between 30 and 50, you've then got a different management style you need to deploy. Lots of founders aren't great at being leaders.
Yeah.
They're control people, they're managers. And that transition's really tough.
Yeah.
And you go from that sort of 50 to then maybe 100 and it changes again where it's
systems. You
know, you go from being, I don't know, sort of an Ernest Shackleton type figure where you are driving everything, you're controlling everything and you're looking after the crew, even mm-hmm. though it's indirectly, to you're more a sort of, I don't know, a Barack Obama, you know, yeah. great orator. You create an environment rather than actually driving decisions. That's very different again.
Why does, and you summarized it really well in what I felt as well, because naively, when I started Unknown, I said, right, I'll get five people, we'll do, you know, we'll get to £1 million. And we did that with eight people and it was great. And we're crazy profit. I think, I remember we were like nearly £500,000 profit in like within our first 2 or 3 years, which was, for me, that was, I didn't really understand profit and all that shit. I was like, okay, cool. We've got loads of money in the bank. That's great. I actually was trying to get less profit because I found out you had to pay HMRC like all this money. And I was like, what the hell? Why would anyone want profit? That's really expensive. You have the less profit. So I was naive. And I was also naive in how it would grow. And I thought I'd be happy with just five people. And then you realize that you owe growth to those people and you can't offer them growth if you are just going to stay at that size.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And I don't think anyone thinks that through. I think everyone thinks, oh, I just want a, you know, 10 to 20 lifestyle, you know, business. Oh,
standing still is death. I mean, it's...
Is that... Have you ever seen... Yeah, because I want to challenge that. Have you ever seen a company or, you know, why is it so rare to see a company stay at sub 20 and be successful?
No, I mean... You and I are both generalizing.
Mm.
So generalizing, I totally agree with your observation. Are they like specialist, I don't know, like behavioral science consultancies that will, because they're so specialist, there's just an inherent limitation as to how much you can scale a business like that without jamming it into a much bigger beast.
Yeah.
Definitely there are. But on the whole, it's a point you've already made. Like our businesses are all about the people and how they work together. And good people, which is what you want to hire and people I want to work with, They want to be in growing environments where there's new challenge, their roles can develop, they're learning new things. And that just doesn't happen in static. Just doesn't happen in static businesses. And that's as true of an accounting firm as it is of a talent firm or an M&A consultancy. It just, you know,
have to offer
it is. You have to offer projection.
Okay, fine. So let's get there because we're going to stick on this growth. Because I wanted to challenge that to say, like, could you, you know, there are companies that have stayed at that size and, you know, founders pay themselves well, whatever. Is there like a Goldilocks pace though? Because you can be growing. You haven't got to be rapidly growing. What's the rush? Because if I'm offering Goldilocks growth and I'm paying myself incredibly well, but the company is still growing 10%, I don't know what you would deem good percentage of growth, 10, 20% year on year. What is the rush?
What's the rush? Well, a couple of different bits aren't there. Businesses that rush will trip over themselves eventually, and they just will. We Are Social didn't trip over itself. It's an absolutely fabulous business. I deep respect and admiration for everyone. It's just created its own market, and I really love the guys. But when I first started working with them in, 2012, they were the only social agency. Like, they were the market. And they didn't have to work that hard because they'd set the thing up and they're with their email address. Like, people would just, you know, they were the social agents. Stuff would just come to them. And when we started working together, it was like, we've got this amazing brand. We're in, 5 or 6 countries by that point. But they didn't really have a company. Mm. It was a brand, people that worked brilliantly together, but there was nothing recognizable as a business behind it. So the first sort of 12 months working together was like, if you want to scale this up anymore, you actually need to build some stuff behind this sort of franchise brand you've got. You need a thing that's a infrastructure to support it. Because if you go much further, the whole thing's just sort of going to fall apart. And the guys absolutely recognized that and piled into it, like really committed themselves to that for a sort of 12-month sprint. But businesses that grow real fast, I mean, they'll just leave the company behind. The brand will sort of detach itself from the delivery reality and eventually it will just fall apart, which is, I think is the sort of, if you look at the current dynamics, that's the sort of risk of the influencer world where clients are so focused on deploying cash into that market because they absolutely firmly believe that's the way to engage their audiences, that your question about what's a good level of growth. But the PR market globally is probably flat. Maybe it's like a 1-2% growth market. So it's broadly in line with inflation. And all that's happening is money is moving around between different PR firms or different sort of disciplines in that space within those budgets. I don't know. I mean, like the influencer spend, the amount of money that's been redeployed from media to influencer, for example. I mean, you might need to be a 20 or 30% growth business at influencer to look like you're kind of keeping pace with the market. But it's going to be wildly different from an advertising or a PR business, for example.
So you would look at the sector of the services that you're in. So let's say like we've got the entire creative economy from media all the way through to PR.
Yeah.
And then, creative agency and influencer in the middle. You would say, right, okay, which other companies are selling what we're selling? Or what's their primary offering?
Yeah.
And what rate is that growing in the economy? And then should my company be growing at that sort of pace? That's how you would...
Yeah, I think I'd... Yeah, yeah, yes, yeah. I mean, I'd look at my market first.
Yeah.
What's my market doing? And anything that's outperforming the market, that's great. I mean, it doesn't mean to say that I'm immediately an attractive business from a sort of shareholder perspective, kind of looking at the other lens you're trying to look at it through, because, media, for example, the media landscape is changing and evolving, so there's opportunity for growth. But in terms of money that's being spent by brands in what you'd kind of classically call media, but that's... It's not a growth market. Who's going to deploy capital? Who feels like they need to own more of that space, which is more and more challenged by Google, Facebook, etc. And then they're owning more of it. They've got more control over it. Is that, would I feel excited about growing 10% in the media landscape? From a shareholder perspective, if I had to put money into a company, would I be there versus an influencer business that's growing at 20%? I'm definitely putting my money in an influencer business because the next 10 or 15 years, that's going to be what it's all about.
Do you believe that?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, sadly, you opening comment about how long I've been doing this kind of stuff. And I grew up in an agency household. My dad was an agency guy. Like, I remember when advertising and media split. Like, the world has changed a lot in a working lifetime. And then you still had like above the line and below the line. Yeah. And then digital, you know, appeared. And digital was different from advertising. And like, well, that was kind of weird in the sort of early 2000s. I think social and influencer is going to be like digital was 20 years ago. It's going to be different. It's you know, digital was like a silo. People would have digital agencies for a while. And then it just became everything. I think the next sort of inflection point for us is everything is about, well, basically, I mean, what is influencer? Going back to pre mass media, it's word of mouth, but just enabled in virtual worlds. Yeah. It's the most natural form of marketing. So logically, that's what it all pivots back to. So I think, I mean, the rest of my working career will be about influencer and social. And I think I've got at least 10 years in me. So
what did the digital agencies, okay, so take me back to 20 years or when, you know, when digital agencies
were 2001, when that was all sort of kicking off.
Name me a couple. Are we talking like Digitas, LBI, AKQA were later than that?
A bit later than that, yeah. So yeah like LBI is a really good example, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So LBI at that point. So are there any learnings that an influencer agency owner could take from an LBI? Because LBI, I imagine they would have exited the Publicis for, I don't know, 100 million, whatever the number was, right?
Yeah.
So that's a win, right? If you're selling your agency for a nine-figure sum, you're doing very well. What did they do well? And what learnings can an influencer agency owner take from that time? If we're seeing the same, you know, growth gold rush moment, are there any holistic learnings?
Yeah, so growth gold rush, is it? It's a genuine, to me anyway, like I'm not a world authority in this stuff. I'm a humble sort of M&A guy. But I look at this as being another transformation moment in how brands sell.
Yeah.
I'm sort of crude and transactional about it. It is about brands selling ultimately. And I just don't see how that's a reversible thing now. I just think it's set until something else comes in that engages people differently, or unless society changes, because there's another way of us all engaging with each other that doesn't involve phones or laptops or screens. Like at that point, it will change again, but maybe it relies on that level of technology change. Like when screens disappear, it will need to change again. But until that point, it will be this method. So I don't think it's kind of gold rush territory, just recognizing the fundamentals of how brands sell have now changed. Like it's not a question anymore. It's moved. So that's the place where you need to be. If you're making bets today, new bets, that's where you need to be betting, because that's just how society is going to work.
Yeah.
So is that gold rush? I don't think it needs to be gold rush, because it's here to stay.
Mm.
It's about understanding the things that are going to, things in society that are going to stay and drive value, and just, you know, identify. I mean, it's simple stuff, I think, just bloody hard to do.
Just on the to-do part, let's imagine, actually, no, before I imagine this, why do people sell their companies, or why do people sell their agencies?
Well, I mean, I talked a little bit about business reasons. I think for clients that we work with, and I don't know whether our competition have got a similar experience, but we talk about, it's not my expression, but I'm one I'm nicking from someone else, but the triple D is the kind of main reason for selling businesses: death, divorce, disease. yes, it's kind of tragic, but like fundamentally, they're human things. You know, so when I talked about Ben and Shah at Born Social, and like they just needed to be everywhere at once for their clients, and that was their thing. So that wasn't one of the triple D's, but that's the minority of occasions for us. Most times it's about the people who've set the business up, and you're solving something for them. So it's retirement. It's the sort of death thing. You know, we can see that we're getting to a place. It's financial circumstances change. And sadly, the easiest analogy there is like a divorce type scenario, and people just needing to change lifestyle, the disease piece, because they're worried about themselves. It's risk. There's some kind of risk or change management that's going on. That's most often what's happening.
But I like that you're being brutally human about that. Like, I think let's be honest, 95% of announcements around M&As would never say, I just got a divorce and therefore I had to sell my company because my finances were looking pretty rough. Or, you know, someone's died and I need to... I've never seen an announcement like that. Whereas, so I think it's a really important conversation to have, because, and I want to get into the what good comes from, like, those 3Ds are obviously like they're triggers, they're human triggers.
They're triggers, and they'll very often be an accompanying business rationale. But you know, one of your other questions earlier about, like, when do people come to our door, and there's a trigger. There's probably already that, like, the business is in a place where this probably needs to happen anyway, but this has happened to me as the individual, the founder. This is the time, as opposed to 6 months ago or a year from now.
Yeah.
It is going to be now. I know we could do it, but I need it to be now because. And we've had, it's some of those experiences, the triple Ds are really uplifting, where you can really help someone with something that's very deeply personal to them, really important to them. And sometimes, frankly, it's a bit kind of sad. But there's, I mean, generally there's a compelling business reason as well, but the trigger is a personal thing that says now is the time.
I want to move into the financial trigger in more comfortable territory now. We're not going to speak about death and divorce. How do you know if you have a business that is valuable and worth selling? What would you quickly say? Have you got this? Have you got this? Have you got this? If you haven't, come back when you got this.
Okay. That's, I mean, it's a great question. And I think that this relativity we've already talked about is really important.
Mm.
I think that there are a couple of different types of sale. First of all, there's a sale which is, I'm going to take my business, I'm going to put it into someone else's business because it just needs a sort of safe haven. You know, it needs to be part of something else because we just don't want to stretch the business that far ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that's the answer to your question is a bit different in that kind of circumstance. Mm-hmm. So there, if I'm comfortable being, I don't know, a customer experience team within Accenture, for example, and I need client access, I need to be able to get through my sales funnel faster. Okay, that kind of thing transacts in a slightly different way. You know, they're 20, 40, 50 people, and you're going to become something else, like a sort of effectively a big team within a
bigger company.
That's different.
Yeah.
I think the kind of stuff that you and I would more naturally talk about is stuff which really feels, you've used Adam and Eve as an example earlier. Impactful, game changing, you know, when's that happening? And what features do you need for a business to achieve that? Well, it's got to be outgrowing its market, or it's got to have the potential to outgrow its market. And the best M&A happens where I can see and articulate the potential that I can't access in my company because I'm missing some ingredients. I'm missing the New York office, the LA studio. I'm missing the particular code writing skills that you have. So yes, you can put me a financial structure together and my profits are going to grow not at 20% anymore, but because of everything that we can do together, we're going to grow the thing at 30 or 40% together. That's where the best M&A happens. So there's a relativity to market. There's a sort of latent opportunity, and it needs to be a sustainable latent opportunity. So businesses, and you see this all the time, they stay independent just that extra 12 months because they're very focused on how much money am I going to get paid on the first day of this deal. Most deals are done on some kind of earnout structure still.
Okay.
So most people would understand earnouts as being, look, I get paid 50% upfront and another 50% later, as long as I perform according to some targets. And so the natural tendency in a growing business is I'm just going to sit in there for another 12 months because that day one number is just going to keep on getting bigger. So my risk in a deal is less because I'm just going to bank that much more the following year.
Okay.
But the question people sometimes fail to ask themselves is, by trading another 12 months, how much of the future growth have I stolen? Because my buyer's not interested in how much growth I've had in the past. They're only interested in what can I do in the future? Like they need to see appreciation in the business. And appreciation stops happening when you've outgrown the market for too long and your competitors catch up. The market starts maturing. Your talent gets fed up and frustrated because you've been sweating them and stifling them for your own personal gain. But you kind of see that stuff all the time.
Oh, so you're saying by longing it out and by thinking you're going to get more money up front. Let's use an example, and I will never name the company. Let's say they're called Mum Momum and Flavas were buying them. So Mum Momum are, you know, I reckon they're probably at the time doing like 50 million. They've grown. Like they're an 8-year-old business, 6 or 7-year-old business, right? And maybe doing somewhere between 50 and 80 million, which would be outgrowing the creative agency market, right? If I'm looking at the other creative agencies out there, Schmablo and, you know.
It's so subtle. Good job you're not an M&A advisor because you'd be sued so often.
But let's, you know, the ones out there, and they've also, you know, we've expanded to New York and we've got these other elements to our business, like customer experience. could they? How could that have gone wrong? Because there's a good sum that could have happened at, yeah. right? Could they have, if they waited 2 more years, could they have got more value out and then carried on going on the trajectory they were? Or do you think they were, you know, that style of acquisition was at the right yeah. time?
Great question. Without getting into your specific examples.
No, of course.
I think that really exciting M&A as opposed to a financial vehicle for getting money out for people. Yeah. And there is a big difference between the two.
Okay.
Really exciting M&A happens where you recognize the opportunity and you talk to a number of people about your strategy, what you need, how you want to accelerate it, the risks you see along the way. And they come back to you and go, I love that strategy. Actually, if we were doing it, we wouldn't need to do it quite your way. We'd think about it a bit different. We'd do this, this, and this. That would look a little bit different, but it would probably get us to here. Mm. How do you feel about that? Like, I wasn't in the room for that particular conversation that you're describing, but I absolutely understand that between the different parties involved, they had that was central to it. That conversation about what could be done better, faster, bigger, and with less risk was absolutely central to it, and the timing of it. So I think good M&A, in my experience, you can't properly evaluate on day one of a deal.
Okay.
You just can't. Can you evaluate it 5 years later? Probably. 10 years later, definitely. Mm. And that's really interesting when you do that. If you speak to, I don't know, get time with Peter Mead, talk to him about how he feels, you know, nearly 30 years after having sold his business to Omnicom. And that would feel, if you asked him the question after 5 years, after 10, after 20, there'd be a different answer at each point. And the financial element of it is definitely part of it.
Mm.
But for really good M&A, it should be able to outlive the financial elements of the deal, which typically expire after like 4 or 5 years.
So if you, okay, when do you know? Let's go back to that. Like, so what are my trigger points to be like, oh, I could have a thing here. What am I evaluating to know whether I could be the next Peter Mead selling AMV to Omnicom? How do I know? Is there an EBIT number, profit number? Let's use my business as an example, okay? I really want to get, and this sounds like the numbers, this is like an ego thing, I think, because I do believe my business... Yeah. This is
good because you're about to answer your own question, but you keep going.
Yeah, yeah. No, but this is really interesting, right? Because I've got this weird insecurity, which is like, until I've built, there's two junctions that I don't know where this came from.
Yeah.
5 million, 1 million EBIT. I think this came from one of my advisors. He was like, you've got to get a 5-1. 5 million turnover, 1 million EBIT.
Yeah.
And then the other junction is 10 million turnover and 2 million EBIT. Very basic. There's something about I have an eight-figure business or I built an eight-figure business with nothing, that there's an ego play in that situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, I also believe the company that I currently have in its current form, and, you know, comparing it to the rest of the market, I believe in this thing called a donut number, which is when it reaches its natural size of being, you know, right profit, purpose, people. Yeah. And I think that number is probably about 5 million, and I think the profit will be about one.
Uh-huh.
But, and I don't think, I call it foie gras, business foie gras. I don't think force feeding any more humans and, like, you know, fucking expanding it out of wherever it needs to be, which I've seen so many of my competitors do.
Yeah,
and then it just becomes this sort of like revolving door situation. As you were saying, the 30 to 80 weird hustle where it becomes systems and organization stuff and none of the original purpose. I don't want to do that. But what I do want to do is utilize the brand of my business, potentially use my profits to acquire other companies in sister industries to what we do, using the holistic philosophies. God, that's wanky. Using what the values of my business stand for across different elements of what we do, right?
Yeah.
So that's a whole load of things right going on there. Basically, the ego in me wants to get to 10 million plus. The reality in me says I'm not going to do that with the current form of my business in what it currently does.
Right.
Where was my question going with this?
Well, I mean, you kind of answered your own. I think you sort of answered your own question in that you started out with, like, what's the right time? You know, when's the right time to go? You've got a couple of different magic numbers going on in your head.
Yeah.
I don't know a single agency owner that doesn't have the same magic number equation going on in their head.
Great.
They've got what's a natural size I can take my business to,
yeah,
without it not being a business? When it ceases to become a business I'm passionate about because it's changed shape because of its size, and it's no longer the purpose that I set the thing up for, at that point, I'm not going to feel good about it. So you've got a kind of, you've got an inherent, at this scale, Ollie's not going to feel great being the chief exec anymore. Founder chief exec is going to be uncomfortable. So at that point, I'm not sure about my relationship. So that's, I need to have changed it before I get to that point.
Okay.
One. Yeah. The second thing that you sort of got to there, I think, was you've also got a magic number. Maybe it's an ego-driven thing for how much money you want to get paid for that business. Those two things are the two bits you've got to hang on to, is that there's a number in people's heads that they want to get paid because it's what their mate got paid, or it's just, it's a number that an advisor's given them or whatever. And there's this sort of natural scaling beyond which it's just going to get a bit weird and uncomfortable. Those are the two things that, that should inform your conversation. If I, a really good example, and I've used them a bit earlier, but I'll do it again because it really, it's striking. When Robin and Nathan at We Are Social were talking to potential advisors back in 2012, I had a really different conversation with them, I understand, from the other advisors they spoke to, which was they both sat in front of me, their trigger, right, theirs, which they wouldn't mind, I'm sure, me sharing, it's a long time ago now, was they wanted to get paid. They wanted to have a business that was capable of being sold at, and I can't even remember now if it's 8x multiple or a 10x multiple. It's one of those two numbers. But that was their thing. It was, okay, we want to get to that. When we've got that kind of business, then we want to sell. Jim, are we there? Like, can we do that yet? It's like, well, that's, you know, because you can't pay your mortgage or school fees with a multiple. It's like cash. Like, so what do you mean in cash terms? Like, what's the number that you're looking for?
Yeah.
And they both gave me their number, which was 20 million quid. I can't remember what the multiple was. And it was like, geez, these guys are torturing themselves on a question that's so easy to answer. So get out a whiteboard, really simple maths, like your profits today are here, maybe making a million or so of profits or something at the time, probably something like that, 1.5 million maybe. Well, if you grew 10% for each of the next few years and you did a normal looking earn out, let's say you sell to Publicis or Omnicom or something, it's kind of going to look like that. So you're already past 20 million. So you don't, and you can do that at like a 6 or 7 multiple. You don't need an 8 or 10. So what is it? Is it the 8 or 10 multiple because you feel good about that with your mates in the pub?
Yeah.
Or is it the 20 that you can actually use to buy your house and set yourselves up with your families, etc.? Oh no, it's the cash. It's the latter, not the former. Fine. In which case, you're good to go. Let's just kind of, let's crack on with this.
Wow.
So I think your point earlier around humanizing stuff, people get lost in. There's something like a cachet, the sort of the buzzwords, the acronyms, the jargon crap that attaches to M&A stuff.
Yeah.
That people love these new terms they've never heard before, but finance guys use all the time. Like, ultimately, there's a sum of money that people need to put in the bank to feel good about life, and then they can kind of relax, breathe a bit, and enjoy business a bit more.
Yeah.
So your two questions speak to the same point.
Yeah.
Ish.
They do. I want to focus on PE for a little bit. PE, yep. Not physical education, you bunch of school kids. We're talking about private equity here.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like, from what we hear and from what we're seeing, it's flooding in the market.
Yep.
And we're seeing, am I fair in saying that? Are we seeing more private equity money in the creative industries, the creative economies, we'll say, than we have seen before? And if the answer is yes, why? And if not, where have I got that from?
Definitely yes.
Why?
Loads of different answers to that. First, really glib answer, and apologies to all our private equity listeners that you might have, viewers rather. There's a bit of a habit, particularly in the UK mid-market private investing jargon, sort of 20 to 100 million pound deals, that people look at other deals like, I don't know, Living Bridge has invested in Brain Labs. Well, that's good. We love Living Bridge. They're a really good firm. They typically make really good money out of their investments. So if they bought a Brain Labs, we better buy Crowd. Sorry, David, at LDC, if I'm not trying to imply that, that investing in Crowd for LDC was a sort of lazy follow. But there is a sort of, there's a lot of proof in the market that private capital going into agency businesses can help them grow fast and successfully. So there's loads of evidence that says, if you've got a pot of money, right? Yeah. So it's what are private equity funds? Generally, it's cash from investment vehicles, retirement funds, that they've already got massive portfolios. They own loads of government bonds, which are low risk, sort of low return, stability things.
Boring 4-5%
returns. Right, got it.
Yeah.
They invest a bunch of money in the public markets, in quoted companies, hedge funds and individual. So they've got kind of public market funding as
safe
well.
Safe money. They've got
return. Maybe. Or maybe you decide you're going to have a massive slug of Tesla stock and watch that go up and down like a yo-yo as well. But you'll have kind of huge portfolios of publicly available, publicly traded stock. The other bit that you want to access is private companies that aren't subject to the public markets and that maybe can outgrow their own market a bit. You know, public companies like an Omnicom or a Publicis, they're almost sort of giant hedge funds. Their ability to grow, when you're already that big, what's your growth going to look like? 5 or 10%? Probably, because you are the market. You know, those four firms are like half the global market in advertising. Yeah. So if the market's only growing at 4 or 5% or less, they're probably going to grow at that pace as well.
Mm.
I'm now the bloke who's looking after, I don't know, the Canadian Teachers Pension Fund, and I've got $100 billion to invest. I actually want to put some of that into some slightly riskier bets. Like, I want to put some things into companies that are smaller in growing markets that can maybe outgrow their market and grow really fast. Instead of 5%, they maybe could grow 50%. Like, some of them are going to fail entirely, but I'm going to get some really, really fast growth in some of those businesses. So that's the PE world is capital. And we've really gone off at a tangent.
No,
I love
this.
Sorry,
this is really good. Really good.
But the mindset there is I'm looking for potential to grow really fast. And some things will not work out properly. But if I'm a firm that's got 10 investments, then 8 out of 10 will be successful, 7 out of 10 will be successful, and a few won't be.
Yes.
But the ones that are successful will be massively successful. Here's my baseball test cricket thing again for you. So that's that sort of world. So because there have been lots of agencies like Crowd, like Brain Labs, like Dept. MIQ, like Dept, that have just blown it out of the park, amazing growth, amazing success, that attracts other PE firms to look at it and go, we need a slice of that. So I mean, there's a bit of that, right? The sort of follower syndrome.
Okay.
It's a really proven market. Wind back to 2001 when 3i were investors in Wolf Olins and Omnicom bought Wolf Olins from them. Like a private equity firm investing in branding and brand strategy like 25 years ago. Wow, that's a real out. That was a ballsy move by 3i because that's a high risk bet on a very famous individual. And it kind of worked out for them. But the market has evolved massively. So there's so much proven success. It doesn't feel like a high risk investment for PE firms now. They know that money can work well in this market. And what you've therefore got is you've got a good 10 years now of private equity firms investing in agency businesses.
Mm.
So Dept is a great example. Original investment into that business has now bought dozens of other businesses that it's operating successfully privately. So you've got kind of two different levels of PE going on. You've got private equity money going into what they call like the platform business. So I'm going to invest in Dept. Then I'm going to put a bunch more money in Dept buying all these other businesses. And if you look at that in total, there's a combination of the platform deals and what gets affectionately known as a bolt-on deal.
Okay.
Nice term, eh? A bolt-on. Yeah, so these that's more than half the M&A market globally now. So private equity money absolutely is the driving force in our industry.
So let's break this down because I think this is really exciting for loads of different people.
Yeah.
I think this is exciting for the global CEO at DDB right now, who's going, I probably earn between $1 and $2 million a year.
Okay. I wonder where you're going with that. Yeah. I can sort of see where you're going now.
Okay, well, you see where I'm going, right? Because I think what we're starting to see is private equity-backed roll-ups, I hear they're called.
Yeah, there you go. Yep.
Where they go, right, we're going to get a Frankenstein. We're going to put all these companies together and build this weird thing, right? It's going to be called... I was going to say MSQ, right? It's probably a bigger version of a roll-up, right? Where you've got, I don't know, between 5 and 10 companies that have been acquired and they've been stuck together. Now, I think that's really exciting.
If Pete hears this, he's going to absolutely lynch you for calling it a roll-up or a Frankenstein's monster or a stitch together.
Fine.
I don't like, you know.
No, fine. But that's like, in its like...
I understand the illustration, yeah.
Basic sense, right? Very basic. We won't use that as an example. We'll use that as an example.
You're right. A group of 10 or 12 companies that have come together around a strategy using private money to do it. So you're not in the glare of the public markets. Gives you freedom to make longer term investment decisions.
Mm.
Like private equity is about growing equity value. That's the know, I put my money into your business. I probably want to get two or three times my money back over 3 to 5 years. That's my equation. So how am I going to do that?
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that by growing the profits by 2, 3, 4, 5 times. It's going to be a combination of growing profits and growing the multiple that attaches to the profits by growing a more interesting business, a bigger business, a less risky business. And the third element that comes into it is when I put the money into your company, I'm not going to just put my money in. I'm going to borrow some money from the bank to do it. This is where you get into financing structures that would be difficult to explain in this format. But bank money's cheap still. I mean, it's not as cheap as it was, but if a bank needs, in the current market, I don't know, 7 or 8% to put its money in, that's still cheap financing. So if I grow a business 30%, but my bank cost is only 7 or 8%, well, I've made 20% growth just in that, for example.
Okay.
So there's arbitrage to be made on bank funding as part of that growth as well.
Because it's going to outpace the money that you like.
Yeah.
In its most basic sense, let's say you put money into a high interest account and you hope for the returns, you're going to get 4 to 5%, whereas this is going to go 30%.
Yeah, but tread with caution. So you wind back to the last time we ever felt that life felt as difficult as it does sometimes today. Go back to 2008. There were plenty of agency businesses that had done private equity deals in 2007 when debt was really, really cheap and when the market went absolutely tits up on them. It got really horrible really fast. Businesses like iLevel that were great businesses but had done a PE deal with too much leverage in. Not at the time they did the deal, but 12 months later, the market had changed entirely on them. And what happens? The bank calls the money back in and you get a fabulous business that's gone. It just disappears off the map. So you do that. The downside of debt as part of the private equity world is it's very unforgiving. That's not patient money. They need to see their return. They are a risk-averse funder. And if their money's under threat, they'll call it back in.
Wow, okay, this is
interesting. Whereas equity investors have got a bit more patience generally and a bit more tolerance. They're like you and I, right? They're shareholders in the company. They're going for growth.
Yeah.
And if it looks difficult, then their growth's going to be lower, or maybe they've got to be patient and wait a bit longer.
Okay.
But the banks don't have to be patient, and that's kind of why they're cheaper funding. If it goes wrong,
they also put it back.
They've got security, and they'll pull it back, and they'll, you know, if they, in the most extreme case, they'll just put your company under to get as much money back out as they can.
Wow. Okay. So I've got a weird thought at the moment, and you might squash this now, but like part of me thinks, okay, if I get to this like 5 million turnover, 1 million EBIT, right?
Yeah.
I could borrow 5 million, probably 5 million pounds off my 1 million EBIT, right?
You might be able to borrow 10 million if you wanted to.
Okay. Right. Let's go 10.
But what are you going to do with it?
Well, I don't know. Just put it on black. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, could I acquire a company? Like, could I go and find an incredible sports, a version of unknown in sports, right? Because we know that's a growing market with the US Olympics happening and FIFA, you know, World Cup heading to the US. Sports is a really growing part of our industry, or part is an industry in itself. Let's say I know another sports recruitment company, talent-based business, and they're doing, I don't know, 500,000 profit. They want to be bought.
I'm going to start charging you for advice, by the way. Yeah. This is going to be an expensive podcast.
But like, I haven't got, let's say they want 5 times, because you say multiples for those that are listening are how many times their profit generally, which is their evaluation. If they're doing 500,000 in profit, 5 times 500,000 is 2.5 million. The sum of money that we've agreed is worth their business is 2.5 million.
Yep.
Now, if I borrowed 10 million, do I need to literally give them 2.5 million in cold hard cash the day that we sign? Or is there a smart way of doing that where I can keep some of that money in my business and then use it for other things?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it would be outrageous if you paid someone 5 times their profits on day one to buy their business and there was no risk and downside for them. That would be like, you've definitely wildly overpaid for that.
Okay.
So don't be doing that.
Okay. So never pay the evaluation.
Well, I think what's the
incentive to
Exactly. Yeah. Why here? How are we working together? How do I ensure that you're going to work to deliver the strategy that's made me want to buy your business in the first place? I'm not paying you for yesterday. I'm paying you for tomorrow, right? That's the deal. So you've got to think about a structure that does that. But in that scenario, you've totally jacked your business up. You're making 1 million in profits. and you've gone, oh, you know, I'm going to borrow, I don't know, 2x profit, 3x profit, 4x, I'm going to, and banks won't generally lend agencies more than 2x their profits. They were getting to 5 and 6x their profits in the old days. And that was insane. You know, it just insane, way over leveraged. Bank lends you a couple of million quid. You're going to spend all that couple of million quid over time on that company. But that company's also generating profits for you, which will turn into cash, which will also be financing its own deal. I mean, we could,
yeah.
You know, I guess the point here is, as we started by talking about why is private equity in, mm-hmm. It's fundamentally in our world because there is the opportunity for growth that's way faster than you can achieve elsewhere, mm-hmm. because society's changing. The way consumers interact with brands is changing dramatically. Media consumption habits are changing. Where there's change and disruption, there'll always be winners and losers. And they'll run this equation that they'll find more winners than losers if they do their diligence correctly and they really think hard about what they're buying and why they've understood the business plans. And if they can make their returns even better by using slightly cheaper financing in the mix, they'll do that. But no private equity firm is ever going to create a structure that is so dependent on debt that if trading gets difficult for 6 months or 12 months, someone's going to pull the funding because then the cash they put into it is gone as well.
I'm with you.
So there's inherent caution in the market.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, the reason why private equity is in our world is, but look at it, you've with your highly, highly well disguised examples of really interesting companies that have grown and done deals, you've got brilliant businesses that are making a real impact in an industry. And that means they are going to be successful. They're going to make, they will make money in a market that generally is sort of changing a lot. So yeah. it's a smart place to put cash, yeah. I think.
Three things then. I want to know, well, actually, before I ask you these three things, what is, if there was one type of creative business right now, it could be influencer, it could be media, it could be data, it could be sports marketing, creative agency, probably isn't the last one. Which business is hot right now that everybody wants to buy?
So without being really boring and repetitive about it, this stuff is always cyclical.
Okay.
There was a time when it was sales promotion, you know, it was brand experience, it was digital, like, you know, way, way back in the day. So whatever I say today will be different in a year or two. But if you broadly look at what's happening in the next few years, sport's my place right now. Because it has so many opportunities around brand engagement with society and culture, with so many big, particularly with an Olympics in the States, like really, really properly big opportunities. So what agency businesses sort of touch the world of sports in the most engaging way? That's, for me, that's the...
Okay.
Once you get past LA, it'll be different again. But like today, that would be my space.
So if you were... Okay. And then if you are running a sports-focused business right now... What do I need to have in my business, whether it's like retained clients, whether it's a certain amount of profit, like when do I become sellable? When do I become, you know, where I could reach some sort of liquidity or some sort of event?
Yeah.
What triggers?
Well, again, these are the, you know, the this is where the question changes more towards what's a buyer looking for rather than what's got inherent value.
Yeah.
I think buyers are going to be looking at, I think it's more difficult if you're a very traditional, because when I think of sport, I think of, because of my, I'm so bloody old, I think about sort of sports sponsorship activation businesses from the early 2000s. Like that's valuable, but it's sort of old fashioned and most people have already got something that does something like that.
Mm.
So it might not be the best thing that I can have, but I've got something. And if I bring something new in, I've got to junk what I've already got. And that's kind of difficult and disruptive. I probably don't want to go there.
Yeah.
So I think the bits around sports that are most interesting are where sports, influence and social are sort of crossing over.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a really a monetary answer to that. I mean, the monetary element of that is I might be running a really cool, interesting looking business that's in exactly that sort of territory.
Mm.
But because of my scale... The two things that you talked about earlier, your ego number and the sort of natural scale, I've not got there yet. So I don't want to do it, but I could do it. And is someone going to make it interesting enough for me to want to go there?
Fair. Okay. Interesting. There's not a...
There's no magic number. I used to really get pissed off. Maybe I should have done this as my rant. I used to get really pissed off when people would come see me and back when I was at Omnicom, and they'd be, oh, we, you know, our advisors told us we've got to 1 million in profits and therefore we're the right size to be acquired. Maybe in 2000 that was true, because the way that deals happened then predominantly was one of the big four holding companies buys your business and they mainly leave it alone for 4 years during an earnout. And at the end of it, you figure out what to do post earnout. And generally, it's like start again because everyone's left. That was sort of the world. And £1 million wasn't because it was £1 million. It just you got to a certain sort of scale that you had some resilience, you had some autonomy, you had some governance, and you could sort of stand on your own 2 feet. And we could just connect you up with some other chief execs and life would be a bit better and a bit more interesting. Mm. So the £1 million was that rather than being a number for its own sake. But like today, you could be a, you know, like I said earlier, you could be a 20-person CX business joining Accenture and that's perfectly acceptable. You could be a 200-person business joining Dept. And, you know, it's there is no sort of magic number for financials. It's sort of different scales of businesses will just naturally gravitate towards different types of deals.
Slippery.
Sorry.
Okay, fine. We're coming to the end. It's so funny because all my questions here were so that I've written at the end. It's like, okay, so 1 million, 2 million is that the time? So yeah. I'm going to cancel all those. Before I ask you my final question about giving a platform for somebody else and who is the person that you want everyone to know, if you could give one of the most classic errors or tell like the founders of the businesses that you are going to meet before they arrive at the doors of Waypoint, what is the one thing that you wish they would all know before you had a conversation?
One thing they should all know. I tell you the one thing that they should all do or stop doing is they should stop having the mindset that is, I think I'm in a place where I want to do a deal for whatever that reason is. And therefore, instead of being really focused on what's important to me, my business, your sort of donut analogy, They've all adopted a mindset which is I need to go see an advisor who will tell me what buyers are looking for, and I will then mold my strategy or my company to fit that. It's total BS. If you built a good business in a great market that's performing and that's attracting great talent and clients, just go after what that business needs. Because if you've got one of those, there'll be plenty of people who want to buy into it or invest in it. I mean, it'll be there. So use what you've already got to just weed out the people who are going to be a waste of your time.
Yeah.
But so many people have come specifically to learn what buyers are looking for so that they can do more of that. Why would you change what you've been doing for the last 5 or 10 years so successfully for a 2 or 3 year period I've never understood the logic to that, but it happens so often.
I guess people would want to move to buyer habits, but then I guess it's you could almost compare M&A to fashion. Like if I said to you, you know, if you came to me as someone that's building a brand and you said, like, I want to do, like, what's everyone buying at the moment? You'd be like, well, at the moment, it's Max or it's rats and shoes. I don't know. Yeah. Like, but don't go do that because by the time you've done it, that'll be old news. That'll
be
old-fashioned.
What I do know is you've got an absolutely great business. If you carry on doing that, the stuff that you need to do is exciting. It will drive growth and profits. Just keep doing that. And don't feel insecure. Like, people who... I need to talk to 20 buyers. I want 10 offers for my company. You get all this sort of stuff all the time. Well, you don't really. I mean, ideally, you'd only talk to one buyer and they deliver you a fantastic offer that meets all your strategic needs and your financial goals all at the same time.
Yeah.
But, you know, the odds of you finding exactly the right person but you build it from that end point outwards. And if that's what I'm trying to do, how many different types of conversations with different people do I need to sort of test out the different ways we might deliver this?
Yeah.
Don't start with, I want to go here so I can speak to.
Sounds so obvious when you say that. Like,
it's great news about being the finance guy. I mean, literally it is. I mean, honestly, it is obvious. Yeah. When you've done it a lot, it is obvious. But if you've never done it before, and most of our clients have never done it before, and they'll never do it again, it's a one-time only thing.
Yeah.
The benefit of the kind of collective learning of 20, 30 years is... Yeah, there are some really obvious rules, but they, you know, it takes real confidence in your convictions that something that seems so obvious is actually
that obvious.
Right.
It
seems too obvious to be true, but it is.
I've really enjoyed this. I've genuinely thank you. And I didn't ever have to really pull you up for jargon. You did a brilliant job.
I had to pull you up, I'm afraid.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. You told me off for jargoning. Okay, fine. But before, I'm going to ask you my final question, which is, this is a nice one. This is you're less on that in the hot seat now.
Okay.
And this is more if there was a human out there that you wanted everybody to know about, maybe they don't. Who would that human be?
Okay. So I think I'm a real Myers-Briggs sort of yellow person. So people very important to me. This is not a person who is not well known already, but I think there is a bit of a generational thing. So my kids who are 20-ish don't really, they sort of, the name is sort of familiar, and I think that's a shame. I'm a massive Shackleton fan. Because I really admire inspirational, risk-taking people who lead from the front. There are so many stories over history of people who've just really inspirational in the way they deal with adversity and bring people along and the risk and sacrifice they take. Mm. But as an individual, you know, the infamous, you know, South Pole trip and how it all went spectacularly wrong and how he looked after and kept every single one on that trip alive, at enormous personal risk and danger to himself is something else. And my kids don't know that history enough.
Can you quickly just say who Shackleton is? I mainly know that because of the jackets. There are Shackleton jackets, okay, right?
Yeah, there are. Yeah. Yes, and the jackets are very nice. And if Martin Brooks and his team would like to gift us both one as a result of this, we'd be delighted to model them for them.
Thank you.
The most famous exploit was trying to cross the Antarctic and having sort of sailed down there on some rickety old sort of wooden construction, done it at the wrong time of year, got caught in the ice, couldn't get as far as they needed to get to make the landing at the right place, which meant they couldn't get their provisions. Boat gets locked in the ice. They can't move at all. Eventually, the boat gets crushed by the ice. They've sort of already bailed out at that point, but they're living on the wreckage of the boat that they've kind of converted into shelters. In order to save themselves, they have to extricate themselves from the Antarctic by like dragging this shit over the ice and climb. You know, it's such a horrific terrain, and they've toughed that out for months and months. They then find themselves sort of, you know, eating seals and, you know, keeping themselves alive with sort of seal carcasses and for months, and realize they're just eventually no passing boats are ever going to find them. They're just going to
either die
of age having eaten seal meat for 50 years, or they need to, you know, get out of there, which then has them customizing a bit one of the old lifeboats. And then a few of the lads basically rowing across the Southern Ocean or whatever that sea is in the wildest possible weather. You imagine it's like a 20, 30 foot boat, which they row, a few of them, saying goodbye to the others who they left behind. Don't worry, we'll be back for you. They nip off to the Falklands, as you do, just row over there, land on the wrong side of the Falklands, and then have to climb a bunch of mountains, having been rowing and eating bits of whale, that's bits of seal carcass, and staying alive in the freezing conditions, wearing like basically a woolly jumper, no Shackleton jackets, just, you know, woolly jumpers in the Southern Ocean. So they do this, they row across, bit of sail power, but mainly rowing in this ferocious sea. Yeah, then they climb a mountain or two, wearing their sort of woolly clothes, knackered, exhausted, physically broken after months and months and months. And successfully find a whaling station. They hear the sound of like the sort of the whaling whistles, manage to, so they then get greeted by the whalers. It's like, bloody hell, your owner Shackleton and his men, what the hell are you doing here? How did you get here? Get themselves cleaned up. Right, fellas, get in the boat. We've got to sail back down to collect the other fellas who we've left behind several months before, who've just been waiting for us to come back. And they're still waiting there. They're all still alive. And Shackleton does what he said he'd done. He led all the men to safety, picked them all up. It's like, how do you do that? How do you find the resolve to just keep going?
Wow, I didn't know that.
So read them. I mean, there are plenty of kind of abbreviated stories and diaries and stuff, but inspirational leaders, you don't really get much.
Wow.
There you go. So I thought that everyone knew about Shackleton.
No.
But way more than the fashion brand.
Did you know about Shackleton? You did? Oh, yes, of course. We all knew about Shackleton. That was not what I was expecting, and I'm really happy you did that.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Jim, thank you. This has been amazing.
Great pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Cheers. Muchas gracias.